California boasts some of the most notorious figures from the Old West. Rough and tumble men who engaged in robbery, murder, and often met their demise in either capture or on the run. However, outlaws can evolve into legends over time. Much like the renowned Joaquin Murrieta, known as the Robin Hood of the El Dorado. Some believe he was a noble bandit, fighting against injustice, while others dismiss him as a mere character from historical fiction. The question then remains, what is the truth, and what is the myth? Well, let me tell you a story. The birds are chirping, the sun shining. Today is going to be a fantastic day. For some strange reason, an enormous wave of emotion slaps Joaquin Murrieta in the face. He sits in the kitchen watching his voluptuous wife cook breakfast as he reminisces silently about how far he has come and how much better his life is here in America. The smell of eggs frying causes his eyes to close and a smile appear on his face. He goes on to think about his life before, a simple 17-year-old boy working on a ranch in Sonora, Mexico. He and his Rosita fell in love and one day were caught by her dad picking wildflowers and he was chased off. The two of them decided to follow his half-brother's advice and move to the great land of golden opportunity, California. Now in the present day, he is rich, he has his own gold mine, and is doing amazingly well. Joaquin pulls out his Bowie knife and chops up a zucchini that Rosita handed him after noticing his gaze upon her from behind. Once he is finished, he lays the knife on the table and walks over to Rosita and pecks her on the cheek. She smiles. And then he opens the door to welcome the unexpected guest. It appears to be a group of hillbilly-looking guys. Immediately, a man on the left spits in Joaquin's direction. Joaquin is a slow-to-anger kind of man, so he takes and politely asks what he can help them with. It turns out that they were not too happy with Mexicans mining in the area. Truth be told, Joaquin was one of the more successful miners in this area. Joaquin told him of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo and his rights, but these men didn't care for a legal lesson and chose to teach him a lesson of submission. The spitter lunged in and socked Joaquin just below the jaw. Joaquin, knowing his knife is on the table, leapt back, and to his surprise, Rosita grabbed it first, her way of keeping her husband from becoming a murdering Mexican who would surely be hung for his crime, whether in self-defense or not. The men seized this opportunity to rail on him, turning Joaquin into a wheezing, bloodied-up mess. They turned to Rosita, who ran, but was caught and thrown onto the bed. Joaquin awoke all tied up and saw the horror of his wife sprung on the bed, herself bruised and all out of tears to cry as the spitter lifted his pants back on and shimmied over to Joaquin and spit once more, telling him he had 10 days to leave or he will be evicted from the earth. They took not even a day to leave and moved onward to what they thought was the middle of nowhere. Somewhere safe, where they rebuilt, only for him to be attacked again by some other men riled up by the simple fact that a Mexican owned land. Joaquin informed them that he had become an American citizen, but they didn't care. He then chose to submit and obey, and to suffer the consequences as he had before. And once again, Joaquin and Rosita moved on, trying out mining in a new place but meeting failure, then becoming a Monte Carlo dealer. This new profession seemed to take a liking to him and for him, becoming a celebrity among the gamblers as one of the best dealers with the most fun table. But again, luck was never in his favor in the game of life. After visiting his brother one day and borrowing a horse to ride home, he was surrounded by a mob. This mob accused him of being a horse thief. The horse had indeed been stolen, but then sold to his brother, who knew not of its horse facts. They captured him, tied him up, and forced him to take them to his brother's house. And he did. As soon as his brother was seen, he was lassoed to a tall oak tree and was lifeless within 2 minutes. And instead of being hung as well, he was bound, facing his still swaying brother, and then given lashes. Each man seemed to want a turn. This is when Joaquin's heart became hardened. He turned and faced the men and gave each one a look down, imprinting in his memory what they looked like so that he could exact revenge when he was freed. If he was freed. When all was said and done, he lowered his brother to the rocky soil and gave him as proper a funeral as he knew how. Thick tears welled up in his eyes. And he swore to his brother right then and there that his soul shall not know peace until his hands were dyed deep in the blood of his enemies. Soon, man was found dead, cut to pieces, seemingly tortured to death. This was one of the men from the mob. One by one, the news spread of another death, another murder, another man of that mob sent down to hell. Soon, no man from that mob lived. But as the taste for ice cream cannot end at a single spoon, nor can the taste of revenge end with the death of the perpetrators, Joaquin would not stop. The enemy now vanquished, his cup remained half empty of the revenge he so desperately craved. Revenge now consisted of an idea, a cause, a deep-seated hatred for the Anglo-invaders known as Americans. This bloodlust extended for the want for money and horses, these crimes now giving the unique title of both outlaw and bandit, and he was only 19 years old. Within a year, fear was upon every white man in the state. Crime was off the charts. Stories of people riding and then suddenly being lassoed off their horse, then murdered in the brush, were becoming more and more common. Joaquin was the leader of an enormous gang that was marauding the land. His sadistic sidekick, Three-Finger Jack, was loyal and enjoyed doing the dirty work. But he didn't care for the cause, he just really liked to butcher the innocent, watching as their eyes became a blank stare and their mouths never shutting again. His favorite part was to play with their bodies post-mortem. He was made famous a few years ago when he and his own little group stripped down a few men naked, tied them to a tree, then used their very much alive bodies for knife-throwing practice. Then, when they got bored, gashed their eyes out, cut out their tongues, and gutted them like a fresh-caught river salmon. Joaquin would use Three-Finger Jack to do his more publicized murders. Since this great gang was anti-American and generally anti-white, the rancheros throughout California that were Mexican were accomplices to the gang. They viewed what they were doing as a just thing to these Americans, these invaders. You could argue that there was a very elaborate grassroots radical racist vigilante group to rid the land of the Americans who had taken over in recent years. Joaquin and his men would go undercover like spies and work normal jobs, lure people into certain situations, and strike. Eventually, it became too much for the governor of California to bear. Something had to be done. So he put out a reward for $6,000 for the head of Joaquin. And after a few months, Harry Love and his band of rangers that were searching for Joaquin downed him. A shootout took place, and in the end, both Joaquin and Three-Finger Jack were killed. Joaquin was beheaded and his head placed in an old alcohol jar. The hand of Three-Finger Jack was severed and also put into a jar. By cutting off the head of the snake that ravaged California, Harry Love brought forth peace to the land. Joaquin's head went on to be a sideshow piece shown by one of the rangers until it found its final resting place at the museum in San Francisco. Then, in 1906, an earthquake shook the museum and Joaquin's head. The head crashed to the floor, and the ghost of Joaquin, now freed, continues to haunt whoever dare disturb him or think upon his plight. This is the part of the show where I tell you that though this story is what is repeated on just about every article you might find, this story is a work of fiction. Historical fiction, but fiction nonetheless. Not all of it is untrue, but a lot of it, in fact, is simply a work of fiction. What I just told you was my adaptation of the original book called Life and Adventures of Joaquin Murrieta by a guy named John Rollin Ridge. From 1850 to 1853, there was, in fact, an uptick of crime caused by Mexican outlaws all over the state. Eventually, in 1853, the first name, Joaquin, was listed as the mastermind. I believe, though, that Joaquin was simply a placeholder name, like John Doe. But because Mexicans were the perpetrators, Joaquin was used. Eventually, five names were put out. Joaquin Valenzuela, Joaquin Asomorena, Joaquin Carrillo, Joaquin Botier, and Joaquin Murrieta. The cry for this anonymous Joaquin became so loud that Governor Bigler put up $1,000 of his own money for the apprehension and safe delivery of Joaquin Carrillo. Harry Love and his rangers were given the task to do this. They had 3 months, and in the third month, after getting nowhere, they came upon a group of Mexicans. They took this opportunity and killed him. They severed the head of one and called him Joaquin Valenzuela. There are a ton of newspaper articles doubting that the head is even the right guy, and one newspaper claimed that it was in fact a guy named Joaquin Valenzuela, but not the Joaquin Valenzuela listed in the five Joaquins. Now, the real Joaquin Murrieta came to California with his brother, his wife, and her two brothers. One of the brothers became a gang leader, and eventually Murrieta joined in. They targeted the Chinese most because they were the easiest targets, but every race was free game. It got a little too much for Joaquin, so he left and lived in LA for a little bit. Eventually, the brother-in-law leader got killed, and Joaquin was given the title of leader. So he took over and continued to kill and steal. There was never any real cause or racial reasoning for anything. He and his gang simply killed and plundered for the same reason any other criminal does. There was nothing heroic about it. After the head was shown and the $1,000 reward was given, another $5,000 was given by the state, and another $1,000 was given by the Chinese people of San Francisco. Now, the truth gets a little muddied at this point as to how Joaquin really died, but it seems that there was some sort of shootout somewhere else, and he died then. The head was made into a freak show piece, and people paid a dollar to look at it. A lady claimed that a lady claiming to be Murrieta's sister saw it and said that it was not her brother. Now, as for the book, it was written as fiction, but in a very realistic way. I would compare it to the short story called The Case of Summerfield, which also was a work of fiction taken as fact by a bunch of people in California. In that story, Black Bart, a character, had the recipe of an insane bomb that would destroy the world. Charles Bowles, the real outlaw, took that persona and played with people's minds, writing poems, then signing Black Bart the P-O-8. P-O-8 was the recipe for the bomb, which I expand on in an episode about him, but back to Murrieta. In his case, it's the exact opposite. Ridge took the real man and made him into a legend. The book is written in a biographical, story-like way, and eventually was cited as a primary source of the real Murrieta by Herbert Bancroft, the historian. This solidified this fiction story as fact from then on. The book was plagiarized a billion times, and the storyline changed with each edition, eventually changing him from being Mexican to being Chilean, his wife's name becoming Carmela, and his revenge story becoming more idealistic, and soon he became part of the Chicano movement back in the 1960s. A play was written where he became this Robin Hood-like character, and he had the new catchphrase, "I am Joaquin, kill me if you can." Then there came a poem called "I Am Joaquin," which went viral. And in somewhat modern time, the character Zorro in that movie, Zorro's true identity is Alejandro Murrieta, and his brother is Joaquin Murrieta.